Blog Talk Radio.
Special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
Channel on Blog Talk Radio, and this is the Boxing Source Radio Show, and I am your host, James Bell, the boxing analyst for the Cold Hard Truth on Sports, and the leader of the Boxing Source social media pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Google+. Number to dial in for Boxing Talk is 347-237-5539. Once again, 347-237-5539. Press the one key to get on queue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. We have, you know, pretty much a delayed podcast here this week. Wasn't able to do it on Sunday, so we're going to do it today. We have a few things that we're going to be talking about in this particular podcast, as there was a lot to go over from the past weekend and a lot to look forward to this coming Saturday. So it'll be a packed show, and we're going to get through it with a 60-minute live session, and then scheduled for 30 minutes overtime. So you want to, you know, basically get into this talk here to, you know, have your take. You know, I definitely wanted to go over the card that was over in Moscow, and then we'll cover what happened over on HBO. So that is, you know, how I'm basically going to tackle it. So, you know, first of all, you had the card that was in Moscow, which included the undisputed cruiserweight championship that was on the line. But you also had a couple of fights over in the arena over in Moscow, as you had, you know, a couple of fights here that, you know, were kind of standing out a little bit in this particular card. You did have World Boxing Super Series semifinalist Maris Bridis, part of the card. You also had Fedor Chudinov as part of the card, going up against Najib Mohammadi. Cecilia Brekhus also defended her welterweight championships against Inna Sagadagou. Oh, man. I had to look at the name first, but it's long name. Sagadakovskaya. That's about as best as I can do with that name. And, of course, the undisputed cruiserweight championship fight between Murat Gassayev and Oleksandr Usyk. First off, wanted to, you know, basically start with the cruiserweight fight with Maris Brydus against Brandon Desloyer. He had Brydus added to the card. Of course, you know, he was at one point undefeated at 23-0 in the World Boxing Super Series final. He fought Mike Perez and won by unanimous decision. And then in the semifinals, he went up against Oleksandr Usyk in a very, very close and very, very tough fight. And, you know, Oleksandr Usyk ended up getting the win by decision there to take the WBC Cruiserweight Championship that you know, was held by Brydus. Now, you know, before the World Boxing Super Series, you had Brydus as a unified cruiserweight champion, as he had the IBO cruiserweight championship alongside the WBC cruiserweight championship when he defeated Marco Huck in 2017 by unanimous decision. But then, like I said, gone into the World Boxing Super Series, defeated Mike Perez by unanimous decision, and then lost to Oleksandr Usyk by majority decision, going up against Brandon Desloyer from France. This is basically, you know, a guy that came in there. To me, it looked like he came in there as a filler. He came in with a record of 11 wins, one loss, and one draw. All of his fights previously were in, you know, France. He had a draw in his second professional fight and a loss in his fourth professional fight. So this was, you know, basically a filler fight to see where Brydus was at this point. And, I mean, to me, I thought that, you know, Maris Brydus was much more, you know, much more skilled fighter, of course, better ability, and I thought he would have, you know, made easy work of Desloyer, but, you know, it didn't really seem like Brandon was engaging in this particular fight. There was a lot of lulls in the action with this fight, in that you really didn't see much coming from, you know, Brandon Desloyer in this particular fight. So you had a clear decision win by Maris Brydus to, you know, get back into the win column. I did say, like, after the semifinal fight between him and Oleksandr Usyk, that there was, you know, talk that that fight was so close that you probably would have called for a rematch between Oleksandr Usyk and Maris Brydus. But we are going to see about that, and I will tell you why once I go into the analysis of the main event. But the other thing that was, you know, part of the fight was the undisputed female welterweight championship between Cecilia Reykus and Inna Sagaidakovskaya. Yeah, I had to say it like that in order to get through it. It was a struggle, but I did get through it. And so, you know, with this particular, you know, with this particular fight, you had Reykus, of course, undefeated, going in there 33-0 against Inna, who, you know, was coming from, of course, is from Russia. Had, you know, first few, you know, basically first few fights over in Russia, but also, you know, traveled to different locations to have fights. He's had, you know, a couple of TKO wins. Win by disqualification and, you know, a few unanimous decision wins before stepping into this fight here against Cecilia Brekus. And it just looks like here that, you know, Iga was in a, was not really prepared for this fight. And that, you know, in over 10 rounds, you had Brekus, just had too much boxing skill, and, you know, way too much experience. And so Brekus was able to defend her welterweight titles, stay undefeated, move to 34-0. And, you know, it looked like, if you were able to, like, catch this particular fight, you saw that, you know, Brekus dominated, but once the fight was done, you really didn't hear much as far as, like, you know, any scores being announced from that. So I thought that was fairly interesting, given that you had Cecilia Brekus, who was, you know, part of the HBO telecast on May 5th, where she was the co-feature to the fight between Gennady Golovkin and, you know, his opponent, that he, you know, that he was basically able to bring up from, like, a 2-year layoff in Veins Mart Erosion. So I think, you know, with a tough fight that Cecilia Brekus had with Kylie Race in that particular date there on May 5th over at the StubHub Center, looked like, you know, she was turning around to go up against someone that, you know, didn't really have as much experience. So that's the thing there that we got here so far. Getting in a caller here from the 646. Real quick, tell us your name, where you're calling from.
Yo, this is Matt. What up, JR?
Yo, good, man. Doing good. Just catching up on a few things here, trying to, you know, share the show link on social media, and currently going through the undercard for the event that was in Russia. Did talk about, you know, Maris Brites scoring the win over Brandon Deslauriers, you know, rebounding from his loss to Usyk, and Cecilia Brekus getting the unanimous decision win over the young Russian. I won't say her last name because I'll butcher it even worse than I've done it before, but her first name is Inna. So you do have that. And also, you know, part of that undercard was a super middleweight bout between Fedor Chudinov and Najib Mohammadi. We know about Mohammadi going up against Sergey Kovalev at one point for Kovalev's heavyweight. You have, of course, Chudinov that had it was a former super middleweight champion, but ended up losing to Felix Sturm couple years ago, and also to George Groves, basically getting knocked out by George Groves. But, you know, in his fight against Najib Mohammadi, I caught, you know, the majority of that fight. And, I mean, to me, I thought Mohammadi was basically, you know, beating him to the punch, outboxing him, like, from, you know, the first round to the end of the fight. And I thought that, you know, Mohammadi would have, you know, got a clear win in this particular matchup. But when the scores basically came out, they had Chudinov getting the split decision win over Najib Mohammadi to move to 18-2. Not sure if you were able to catch that particular fight before the Usyk-Gassiev fight, were you?
Yeah, I did catch that fight. That was probably one of the worst robberies I've seen all year. And me, I don't like to use the word robbery a lot because I think it's an overused term, but I think it's really apropos for this fight because anyone with eyes, there's no way you thought Chudinov won that fight. Even Chudinov didn't think he won that fight. He looked embarrassed, you know, when his name was called, when his hand was raised. Fans were booing him. It was just an all-around bad situation. That actually made me think that Usyk wouldn't be able to get a decision in Russia because I don't know how any judge could say that Chudinov won that fight.
Yeah, I didn't see it either, how a judge could really score it for Fedor Chudinov when, you know, Najim Mohammadi kind of felt like he was more comfortable being there in the super middleweight division when he was up at, you know, light heavyweight, particularly against Kovalev. He just didn't really stand a chance in taking those punches from Kovalev. And, you know, even though Kovalev is, you know, one of the most powerful punchers in the light heavyweight division, I mean, still, you have someone named Mohammadi that really couldn't budge that many people in at light heavyweight. So he went down to super middleweight and was able to, you know, take it to Fedor Chudinov, and I thought he out-hustled, you know, basically out-hustled Chudinov and outworked him, and I thought he earned that win, certainly earned that win, but a couple of judges felt otherwise. So, what else did you gather from that particular fight, particularly from Mohammadi being there?
Nothing really. I mean, it was just, to me, it's just two guys that just aren't top-level guys, just two DC fighters. I don't think this is going to become a bit. I don't think these guys are really going to go anywhere. Mohammadi, we've seen what he is at the top of the sport. He's basically a stepping stone or just a filling kind of opponent. And Chudinov, you know, after Groves gave him that work, you know, I think we've seen the best of him. I think he's just about done also. So, you know, to me, it was just a crossroads fight for both guys. And I think even though Mohammadi won the fight, I don't think much is going to become of it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like this was for a minor super middleweight title. So, I mean, it kind of places Chudinov somewhere in those WBA rankings at super middleweight. So, I mean, he's already there at number one, actually. So I guess he's, you know, waiting for what happens with George Groves in his fight in that World Boxing Super Series final in that instance. And, of course, we had the WBA regular title change hands recently. So with Rocky Fielding getting the win over Tyron Zuge. You know, maybe Chudinov could go up against Fielding, but the way that he performed here, I really don't see him even beating Fielding, especially, you know, with Fielding having that much momentum in this case. Having another caller in here, area code 205, what's going on with you?
Hey, what's going on? This is Mike from Atlanta. Calling from Atlanta. How you doing?
Good. You know, getting started here with the boxing talk, going over most of the card that happened in Moscow before I get to the main event of Oleksandr Usyk and Murat Gassiev. Were you able to catch anything other than the main event for this particular card?
No, I didn't catch the girls talk or fight. No, I didn't catch her. I only caught the main event.
Yeah, Bekus had like something, you know, there with a younger guy. So, I mean, a younger fighter her first name's Inna. I'm not going to say her last name because it's like way too much for me to try to go through and I'll butcher it real bad. So With that being said, I'm going to go right into the main event that was there in Moscow. Undisputed Cruiserweight Championship of the World. You had Agasayev coming in there as the IBF champion and the WBA super champion, going up against Oleksandr Usyk, who came in as the WBO champion and the WBC champion. Usyk coming from, you know, the Ukraine, and Agasayev coming from Russia, not that far away from Moscow. Very highly anticipated fight between two undefeated fighters. We had, you know, Gassev coming off a high with the TKO win over Yunier Dodikos, while Usyk had a tough battle with Maris Brightis to get that decision win, to win the WBC version of the Cruiserweight title. And coming into this fight, many of us thought that it would be a tough, close fight between both of these guys. But we got in there round one. Usyk came out there with the jab. Used his right hand to pump the jab, and move over to the right. And Murat Gassayev didn't really do anything. Like, it was the same way in round two. And it was basically, you know, the start of a repetitive process for the rest of the fight. You didn't really see Murat Gassayev make many adjustments at all, or any adjustments to the game plan that Oleksandr Usyk had. Now, with coming into the fight, a lot of people were, you know, buying into, you know, Gassayev's power there in the cruiserweight division. But, you know, with Usyk executing the game plan that was out there for him, using the reach advantage that he had, and he just used his, you know, background and amateur pedigree to basically give what I call a master class against Murat Gassayev, and he scored a unanimous decision win. It was nearly perfect scores all across the board. One judge gave Usyk every round, while the other two judges, Mauro DeFiore and Philippe Verbeek, gave, I say, one round, but it just, you know, still didn't really matter. You just had Oleksandr Usyk stay undefeated, get the Muhammad Ali trophy, get all of the cruiserweight titles that, you know, the cruiserweight titles that are out there, including the Ring Magazine title, Lineal title, and all four major cruiserweight championships that are out there. And, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, if y'all have followed this podcast for the past, you know, six to 8 months or so, but when the series started and they had the drawing out there, I told people, I was like, yo, Oleksandr Usyk is going to be the guy that's going to take this tournament. And this particular fight to me kind of showed why I bought so much into Oleksandr Usyk for this tournament, because he showed like how much actual skill that he has. And, you know, if he comes up with the perfect game plan and prepares for it very well, he can't really be touched there in the cruiserweight division. Before I even continue on it, I want to get your initial thoughts from Matt first, and then Mike.
I don't really have much to say. I was very Gassayev's performance, to be honest with you. I think the blame lies squarely on the shoulders of his trainer, Abel Sanchez. You know, one thing I've been saying about Abel Sanchez is when his fighter's plan A doesn't work, there's no plan B, C, or D. And I think we saw that once again from an Abel Sanchez fighter. I don't know you know, what it is, Gassiev had nothing for Usyk, like absolutely nothing, you know, and Usyk didn't look good in his last fight versus Briatis, you know, and Gassiev, you know, performed very well. He showed great boxing skills, fluidity, movement, power, all of that versus Junior Dordikos. But then it was like he basically crashed the bed in a big moment, man. And I'm not too sure if this is going to be the last we hear of Gassiev on the top level. To me, this was a Joe Calzaghe versus Jeff Lacy type of beating. I couldn't believe how easily Usyk beat Gassiev. He had Gassiev scared to throw, and I don't think Gassiev is going to be able to build his confidence back up anytime soon after this crap performance he gave.
Well, two things about you bringing up the trainer Abel Sanchez, or, you know, like some people call him Fable Sanchez, that, you know, a lot of his fighters that he has trained, like you said, if the plan A doesn't work, then there is no plan B, C, D, F, you know, or L, O, M, N, O, P or something, you know what I mean? So it's like you would have thought with someone of the caliber of Murat Gassiev to make some type of adjustment to, if he wanted to plan into the inside, then, you know, do something else to get to the inside, or, you know, try to move your head a little bit, be a little bit more active as far as, you know, trying to, you know, affect Oleksandr Usyk, because he didn't give Usyk any type of second look or anything like that going through these fights. That really tipped me off right there. But as far as, like, Gassiev's overall status in the cruiserweight division, I think he could still be competitive in the cruiserweight division. It all depends on what happens in the future with Oleksandr Usyk, which I will get into a little bit later. But I want to get Mike Grady's analysis of this fight.
So, I hit it on the head when you said that the thing that Usyk did from round one, it was exactly the same thing that he did from round 12. And it was very repetitive. It made me actually fall asleep. I fell asleep on some of the rounds and I woke back up. And I was like, is this still in round three? And, you know, it was just hitting. I don't know. It was boring to me. It was boring. Like, you know, don't get me wrong. When I saw Usyk, I thought of Lomachenko. You know, I thought of a bigger Lomachenko. Like, the way he, don't get me wrong, they're different. But, you know, his fluidity and even, like, you know, If you have a bigger Lomachenko in a larger weight class, that's how I figure he would look, you know. And it don't look like Usyk got a lot of power. Lomachenko, I guess speed equals power, but yeah, it was just kind of boring. I think that I would need to watch some more of his fights, maybe more competitive fights, to see more from him. Because, you know, yeah, it was just like, it was too easy. And that was my first time watching him, too. It does not take anything away from him. He seems like a very skillful guy. But I didn't see his last fight when he was tested. But, you know, I would love to see him tested and to see how he performs under fire and to see, like what he really is made of when everything isn't going his way, because it looked like everything was going his way. When I was woke, stuff was going his way. I fell asleep. I figured stuff was going his way. I woke back up. Stuff was still going his way. It just, yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing about this particular fight, is that you just saw something where Usyk just had a basic game plan, and
there was just no answer whatsoever, you know, coming from, you know, Murat Gostev. And you would have thought someone of his skill level would have been able to give a better type of effort in this particular matchup. So, you know, here, just seeing Oleksandr Usyk just do the same thing over and over and over and over and over again was just, you know, kind of surprising to many. But, you know, for those that really, you know, bought into the overall potential of Oleksandr Usyk, they saw what they basically expected from him. I think what really kind of like had, you know, Murat Gostev basically give up in a sense was when, you know, even though Usyk was basically doing the right jab and right jab, every time that Murat Gostev tried to come in, Usyk just had like a big, like two-hand combo counter. Just like 1-2, bam, bam. And, you know, with that, that kind of like threw off the timing of Murat Gostev. And just, you know, over like round 4, 5, 6, 7, that just went into the psyche of Gostev. And he just kind of realized that he didn't really have much of an answer to what Oleksandr Usyk was doing, because Usyk wasn't standing right there in front of him like, you know, Yair Dodikos probably did. And, you know, Usyk just kept moving away from that right hand. So it wasn't like, you know, if, you know, Gostev was able to get in range, he would be able to use that right hand, because even if he was trying to get close, Usyk was already out of the way or out of his line of vision. So he had to reset and then, like, go basically start from scratch as far as, like, his overall approach to Oleksandr Usyk. So with him not being able to do that, it was just something where it was, like, a sign of, like, he really couldn't do anything against Oleksandr Usyk right there.
So I have a comment, though.
Yeah.
So you made the comment that he had a simple offense and Gassiev didn't know how to capitalize on that. And it, like, I'm not trying to compare this man to Lomachenko, but it puts me in the mind of Lomachenko's last fight, to where he faced a guy who had a multi-layered, you know, approach to countering and stuff. Like, it just wasn't one typical approach.
Right.
You know, he did multiple things to get inside, and then, you know, I forgot what he was doing, but it was one thing in particular that he kept doing that was, like, really allowing him to hit Lomachenko. And so it speaks to the fact that the guy who going to beat Usyk or give him trouble is going to have a multi-layered, you know, approach in countering or, you know, going about attacking somebody. You just can't be the simple run-of-the-mill, go-forward type guy unless you just got that much more power than him.
Yeah.
Guys on the top level, they have, you know, it's layers to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They have layers to
it. Yeah, you were referencing Vasyl Lomachenko's fight against Jorge Linares over in Madison Square Garden, where, you know, Linares, even though, you know, he may not have been the more skilled fighter, he had the experience over Vasyl Lomachenko, and he was able to do a couple of things with Lomachenko to, you know, either, like, avoid a couple of shots or to basically get in the inside and score very well at one point, and also utilize the counterpunch to, you know, basically get to Lomachenko and also capitalize on the openings that Lomachenko had in that particular fight, which, you know, led to the knockdown of Lomachenko in that fight. Loma was able to, you know, adjust from KO win, but to your point, with Oleksandr Usyk, you may have to see him go up against a guy that really doesn't respect his power, so to speak, or his overall skill. And that might have to be in the heavyweight division. There's been talk that, you know, with Oleksandr Usyk, you know, basically beating all of the top fighters that are there at cruiserweight, you know, with the Peter Marco Huck, you know, who was a very, very prominent fighter in the division over the years, defeating Maris Brightus, of course, and now, you know, clearly beating Murat Gassev. You know, the immediate talk has been for Usyk to go up to the heavyweight division, and one of the first names that was mentioned there, you know, for him, you know, was, you know, a guy that had a couple of fights over in the heavyweight division, but was not that far removed from cruiserweight, and that is Tony Bellew, who is the former WBC cruiserweight champion. So that, you know, fight is immediately talked about being in the cards, specifically since, you know, like I was saying, Tony Bellew has been a former cruiserweight. And, you know, other than those fights against David Haye, you really haven't seen Bellew really step up to fight another guy in the heavyweight division. So that is one of the fights that has been talked about. Matt, what do you think about that as a potential matchup in the future?
To me, that's easy work for Usyk. You know, after Usyk's performance against Gassiev, you know, it sent me into a tailspin, a sort of depression. I got another pick wrong. Killing me, man. So I went back and I watched literally every Usyk fight, the fights where he did really well, the fights where he struggled and couldn't get the guy out of there. I watched him versus Michael Hunter again. I watched him versus Briatis again. And, you know, I realized something. Usyk seems to struggle against guys with length. And Tony Bellew only has a 74-inch reach. Usyk has a 78-inch reach. So there's no way for Usyk to keep – there's no way for Bellew to keep Usyk off of him with his jab or anything like that. So
right.
I think that you'll probably see Usyk run roughshod over everyone until he meets someone with the proper length to defend against him. Whether or not that'll be someone like Anthony Joshua or Deontay Wilder, you know, we don't know what Usyk's plan is as it pertains to moving up to heavyweight. I think if he moves up to heavyweight, he'll be granted an immediate title shot by one of these sanctioning bodies because he is the champion for all their belts. So
yeah.
I think a bigger heavyweight will give Usyk problems. Other than that, it's his boxing world to rule.
Yeah, that little point there with him being the undisputed cruiserweight champion of the world, if he is able to, you know, basically move up to the heavyweight division, the sanctioning bodies will, you know, automatically, you know, place him high there in their respected rankings. So while you do have, of course, that fight against Tony Bellew as a possibility, there, you know, are a few other guys that he could probably face within these ranking systems where he could probably have a good shot to defeat some of these guys. You know, this week you're going to have, according to one caller that's on here, one of the most overrated fighters in the heavyweight division, and Carlos Takam. He will be fighting on July 28th. And, you know, if he gets through that fight, that could be another possible opening match for Oleksandr Usyk in the heavyweight division. Mike Reddy, you got any input as far as like, what Usyk could do?
Well, I have a question. Y'all think he going to
give the titles back? Because that seems like what people, like the route people go now once they unify. So somebody else won't do the Jermaine Taylor like thing. You know, they just give the titles back. You think what's going on?
Well, I mean, it's you know, either, you know, giving titles back or vacating them, like how Terrence Crawford, who won the Undisputed Super Lightweight Championship, ended up, you know, giving up or relinquishing those belts there to move up to the welterweight division and eventually fight Jeff Horn for the WBO welterweight championship. So with Bullington Usyk, if he does move up to heavyweight, then there goes all of those cruiserweight belts, and he'll, you know, be put in a position to, you know, either challenge for a high ranking for one of those world title belts at the heavyweight division, or, you know, maybe possibly have a shot against one of those champions that are out there.
He need to stay away from the world of giants and, you know, stay in the world of men with the 6'3" and below people.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the thing with the heavyweight division is, like, it's kind of, like you say, those that are around 6'3" or 6'4", and then there's guys that are 6'6", 6'7", and 6'8", where they have a much longer reach and could just basically use their length and their size to overpower you, and you won't really have that much of an answer to, you know, what they can do. So, yeah, with that one, I just, you know, kind of see only a few options out there initially for Oleksandr Usyk before he has to basically step up to fight the higher-ranked fighters in the heavyweight division out there. So that, you know, basically is what, you know, got out of the card over in Moscow. If you are listening live on Blog Talk Radio, number to dial is 347-237-5539. That is 347-237-5539. Press the 1 key to get on queue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. Next up is, you know, what's going on at, you know, that happened on HBO, where you had the super featherweight title for the WBA on the line and the WBO super welterweight title on the line. First, you had at super featherweight Alberto Machado going up against Rafael Mesa, and that was for that WBA super featherweight title. You know, he had Machado, seeing if he was going to be, you know, basically that dude coming out of, you know, Puerto Rico, did win the WBA super featherweight title last year with the KO win over Jezreel Corrales. Did have a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a struggle with Corrales, but was able to, you know, catch him with a good little shot and put him down on the canvas and, you know, eventually get that KO win. But, you know, came in here to face Rafael Mesa that was coming from Ghana, undefeated at the time, 31-0, 31 wins all in Ghana. So this was like his first fight in the United States, going up for the WBA Super Featherweight Championship against Machado. So here it was just something to where, you know, we wanted to see if Machado basically had the goods, one, and then two, he was in the quote-unquote serious to the WBA super champion in that division, Gervonta Tank Davis. And, yeah, beforehand, we didn't really see that he really would have had, you know, much of a chance to really get to Gervonta Davis. And even though Machado was able to get the win by decision, here by unanimous decision, you really didn't get much of a, you know, you didn't get something to where you said, oh, I think that he can really get to Tank Davis. I didn't see that in this particular fight at all. I'm going to start with Mike Grady. If you were able to get on HBO and watch this co-feature bout.
I wasn't listening. Who was in it again?
Yeah, this was the WBA regular super featherweight championship between Alberto Machado against Rafael Mensah.
Let me let somebody else talk about it. Maybe I'll remember something because I think I might have watched it, but I don't know.
If it was, if you were able to catch it before the Munguia fight. Matt, you got anything on it?
Yeah, I got something on it. Where do these sanctioning bodies find these obscure Africans to come over and have these mandatory bouts? You know, the announcers from HBO said that this was the first time that Mensah actually got paid for boxing. How the fuck did they find this guy, first of all? Like, they must have, like, the greatest scout team ever for them to find this guy, and he somehow became a mandatory, and he's never been paid to fight before Saturday. That was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard in my entire life. This guy had nothing for Machado, and Machado's not even really that good. And he had nothing for Machado. He made Freddie Roach look like a good trainer again.
I mean, my thing was this, right? With Machado winning that WBA regular title against Corrales, Jezreel Corrales, to beat Corrales wasn't really, you know, somebody that I kind of like highly rated, particularly in, you know, his fight against Castellanos. I just didn't really see like what he had that really had him stand out against, you know, everybody else in the super featherweight division. And, you know, even though he's a tough fighter, he's not very polished there. He kind of has like a very wild style that, you know, doesn't really work very well in the super featherweight division. And if you were kind of like on point as far as like your technical skills are concerned, you would be able to blow out somebody like a Jezreel Corrales. So, you know, if you had, you know, somebody like, you know, Machado, who's supposed to be this, you know, highly regarded guy out of Puerto Rico, seeing if he's going to be the goods. You know, he has that nickname El Explosivo. So what did he have here that could have, you know, basically given people something to say, hey, oh, okay, this guy is really good? You didn't really see that against – I didn't think that I saw it personally in his fight against Jezreel Corrales, and you didn't see it here in his fight with Rafael Mensah. And like you were saying to your point about Mensah and other fighters like him, it's kind of – like a head scratcher to see how are they able to find these guys, you know, not just particularly from, you know, countries in Africa, but, you know, over in Europe, over in Asia, things like that, where they have built up these records, like a 31-0, 25-0, 37-0, and all of those fights are in that one country, and then all of a sudden they get pushed into this world title fight without, you know, having a significant fight beforehand. So that's, I think, what you got here with having Rafael Mensah step in the ring against Alberto Machado, and even with that, it still wasn't much of a very impressive performance.
I don't care nothing about none of these guys. All these guys is food for Tank Davis. You know, I'm just waiting to see when they're going to match these guys up. Only the main event was really that interesting. The first fight really wasn't that interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what I got out of this one. Speaking of that main event, you have Jaime Munguia having that first defense of the WBO Super Welterweight title, going up against Liam Smith. Of course, you know, Liam Smith being a, you know, former guy there that had the had that WBO Super Welterweight title before losing it to Canelo Alvarez, basically get hit in the body into the mat in the heat, you know, all curled up in the ball or something like that, you know, in his KO loss. And then in Beefy Smith's next fight after that, he fought someone that was had a record of 2 wins, 37 losses, and 1 draw over in Barcelona. I don't know how that was able to be signed off. I don't know. That's probably as, you know, much of a head scratcher as, you know, having, you know, Mensa there fighting for, you know, the world title. And then he had, you know, those 2 wins over Liam Williams there. So, you know, one of those fights was for the interim WBO belt. And, of course, you have Javi Munguia winning that WBO title over Saddam Ali, basically bum-rushing him, being a bigger guy, and just washing Saddam Ali. So you have this fight here. And, of course, over the past couple of weeks, I had expectations that I really didn't see Liam Smith lasting more than 4 rounds, but we apparently got something different. Liam Smith was able to make it. He was able to really make it. One, and then two, he kind of showed a good amount of openings that were out there and available on Jaime Munguia, and showed that Munguia has a lot of work to do to polish himself up as a more complete fighter, particularly in this super welterweight division where, you know, you have guys that are bigger, that are big or as big as Munguia is, but also have, and they could catch Munguia with a real good shot and really hurt him. But, you know, yeah, even with that, you know, Javi Munguia was able to get that unanimous decision win to stay undefeated and keep that WBO super welterweight title. Start with 646. What's your analysis of this event, this fight?
I think you're kind of way off base with your analysis of the fight, to be honest with you. I think because, you know, I thought that Munguia would maul Smith also, but I also did leave the caveat that this is the first time that Munguia is going into a fight with real expectations and real pressure. So I thought there was a chance that he could be caught sleeping. I think that in the beginning of the fight, you saw that he did get caught sleeping. He thought he was just going to walk in, walk him down, beat him up, beat him down, and end the fight. And Smith was able to, you know, hit him with some nice counter shots, boxing move. But something changed. In the middle of that fight, Munguia just said, fuck it. I'm going to kick this guy's ass. I'm going to go at him. I'm going to do what James Toney likes to say. I'm gonna give ass to bring ass, basically. And to me, Munguia transformed in the middle of that fight. And I think that he's only going to get exponentially better from here on out. I think he's ready for the Herds and the Charlos of the division already, because I think his class was this fight. And this fight showed that he is ready for the big stage, because he switched up his game plan in the middle of the fight, and he really started killing Smith to the body. And even when the referee warned him for low blows, that did not deter him from going to the body, which to me shows a level of maturity and confidence in your ability to execute your game plan. So I think Munguia showed a lot in that fight, even though the fight went to a decision.
Well, I felt like, you know, he wanted to do that. I thought he wanted to basically do that from the jump. But, you know, Smith was able to, you know, kind of like throw him off that type of a game plan and catch him a little bit. But, you know, still, like you were saying, that's supposed to be the bigger guy. I'm the champion. I gotta show why I'm the champion. And he was able to, you know, do that in the middle of the fight and eventually get the clear, you know, the unanimous decision win over Liam Smith right there. But I mean, like I was saying before, I just really felt that, you know, that Smith wouldn't have been able to handle the overall pressure of Jaime Munguia, and I thought it was going to basically start from round one and then constantly go down from round one until he would have eventually broken Liam Smith down. But it went 12 rounds there. Mike, what you got on it?
So I thought it was the best fight of the night, of the day. Best fight of the day. And I think it's one of those fights that could be considered, like, for the, you know, I may be going too far for saying fight of the year, but I thought it was a pretty back and forth fight, you know, like it was a lot of action and stuff. So it was a great fan-friendly fight between both guys. And it was a good win for Munguia, and it was a good test for him. I think that I think, yeah, he can only get better because he's young.
Mm-hmm.
But his handlers better make sure they know who is exactly in front of him. Because if they don't, like, take him in a nice, you know, linearly fashion to where they know who's in front of him, his youth and his lack of defense will get taken advantage of. And that was shown yesterday when he got hit way too much, like from round one. Smith came out and got his attention, you know, like you're right in that something switched and he was like, fuck it, let's go. But at first, you know, like you could see him being like, well, damn, you know, like he really started, you could see him thinking. And at some point he was like, fuck it, let me stop thinking. Let me get him. And, you know, he feeling it, screaming and stuff, doing his whole, you know, Rocky impersonation. And so my thing is he might want to lose that rockiness because his shelf life will be extremely short as he continues to, you know, level up his competition. I think that the biggest positive from Munguia on the night is that he went 12 full rounds. He was consistently punching. He was continuously getting hit. And for the most part, he didn't really gas. Like, he took breaks, I guess, but he didn't necessarily gas. Like,
right.
Gassing is Anthony Joshua, you know, falling over the ropes like he in Strongman or something, one of them little tournaments that they used to do back in the 2012s or something. But Smith definitely fought his heart out, and it was a great fight, man. I really enjoyed the fight, and I think, you know, those two guys put it all on the line. Smith came out there, and he wasn't going to let the night get away from him. I think Munguia did show a sort of maturity in that he was going to the body, and that took a lot of wind out of those sales.
Mm-hmm.
And the older guy turned into the older guy, and the younger guy turned into the younger guy. And whoever told him to, like, stop trying to just headhunt and start going to the body, that was the best thing they could have done. Like, Andre Ward showed people, no matter who you're dealing with, even wasn't the guy who fought Lomachenko, wasn't he going to the body too?
Linares.
Either one. Did either one of them go to the body? Linares did go to the body some, right?
Yeah, a little.
Yes, yeah. At some point, he kind of did, but he was more of like a, someone that was like concentrated on what Lomachenko was doing to a certain extent, and then making adjustments from there.
And reacting, yeah. So the point I was gonna make though is that Andre Ward should have shown people that no matter who you got in front of you, granted now when you got a speedster and you got somebody like Lomachenko, this is different, but it could be a little different. But going to the body, that's your friend. Jabbing and going to the body, those are two winning formulas. That's what kept Timothy Bradley in the first fight with Manny Pacquiao, and he got away from that, on the other two fights. Like, I don't think he really threw many body shots on the third fight. And, he almost got stopped.
Yeah, that, going to the body is basically the, like digging into the toolbox. I mean, it's kind of like strange to me why more fighters don't really do that to try to test the attrition of the opponent. Because, if you could get to the body well, you're going to definitely affect the overall stamina of your opponent. So I don't see why it's not, utilized in a, more effective manner by a lot of. Real quick, stepping into the overtime section of the show here on Blog Talk Radio. So this part will be on later on the Blog Talk Radio site. So you'll be able to listen to the podcast in its entirety right there. But yeah, going back into what this particular fight was, and it kind of had a little bit of a good action between the two. In reference to this particular fight, did you feel that it almost had a look like how the Herd Trout fight was, with the exception of the start by Liam Smith? Because Austin Trout, of course, had like a very, very good start against Jared Herd, but all of a sudden, Jared Herd just said, fuck it, I'm the bigger guy, I'm gonna, just impose my will on Austin Trout, and he ended up stopping Austin Trout. But here with Jaime Munguia, he was able to, adjust and make the adjustments to have better success against Liam Smith.
So I actually do believe, I do believe Trout, where he said he was dehydrated. Because if you look at the fight where he fought the Charlo twins, either one of them, it was a different guy. Granted, now he wasn't getting leaned on, he wasn't getting pummeled for like 12 rounds per se, but I think something was up. Like, he would have lost the fight, but I think the ending would have been different.
Yeah, so that kind of attributes to his overall fighting style and this because he likes to, kind of dip and move his shoulders a little bit and kind of use his legs. But when his legs are basically gone, all he can do is, basically rely on his move his head and move his shoulders to avoid punches. Saying, you did see that with the Charlo brothers, but you didn't see it against Jared Herd.
And mentally, I couldn't even say that. You could tell he was defeated, but mentally he was still in it, sort of. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was defeated, but he wasn't the guy who Pacquiao beat. You could see that when his mind go, when he get behind, when things go wrong for him, it just crumbles. Everything crumbles. But Liam Smith, I think that even after he got hurt, he showed some good stuff, because shoot, I think he did what he needed to do. The times where he needed to throw big punches and sort of let Jaime, like, hey, back up, look, back up, young guy. You know, give me a little space, because, you know, I will hit you with these hard shots, you know. And granted, that didn't stop Jaime from trying to knock him out, but he did enough to not get walked over, sort of.
All right, gotcha. Yeah. Yep. Definitely agree with that. Definitely agree with that. Any closing remarks about the fight from you, Matt?
I just want to see Jaime Munguia versus Jabbar Hurd. Fight I need to see. To me, that is Ward versus Gotti. That is Corvallis versus Castillo. That is the fight I want to see. Just two guys who don't give a damn. Two guys who don't have much defense. Two heavy hitters. Two relentless guys. I think that's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, I feel it's going to be very, very big fight between those two, but not very likely that we're going to see that in the near future or in the semi-distant future. Looking forward to seeing Jermell Charlo versus Jared Hurd first. You might see it by the end of the year. I wouldn't be surprised if you do. And then, basically after that, we'll see what happens with Jaime Munguia and where his direction is going to go in the super welterweight division. Like I said, we are in the overtime section of the show. Just wanted to, get in the last little tidbits about the major fights happening on July 28th. Starting with the fight card that's over in the O2 Arena in Greenwich in the UK, headlined by Joseph Parker versus Dylan White. Of course, two heavyweights, two guys that, have the – if you were, promoting this fight, say that two guys that went back down from each other, two guys that are, quote-unquote, very tough fighters. One being, of course, a former world champion, the other being a top contender in the heavyweight division. And I'm looking for this particular fight to be a very, very good fight there in the heavyweight division. So, that's what I basically get out of that. You also have in the undercard Derek Chisora against Carlos Takam. The unified lightweight, female lightweight title on the line with Katie Taylor going up against Kimberly Connor. A few other fights, including David Allen going up against Nick Webb, and Connor Benn also with an undefeated record there in the welterweight division. So that's what, you basically have there in this fight card on O2 Arena by Matchroom Boxing. I'm going to start with Mike Grady and see what you got on the Dylan White-Joseph Parker fight and who you may be picking.
Who do I pick? Like, Dylan White, I think he'll gas. I think if Joseph Parker don't get caught with nothing crazy, then he should win the fight, later in the match, because I feel like Joseph Parker has better win. Don't quote me on that, but I just feel like it. I feel like Dylan White going to gas, because he going to go out there throwing big punches, swinging, wild, throwing left hooks and stuff. And I can see Dylan White, winning it in the later rounds. I mean, not Dylan White, Joseph Parker winning it in the later rounds.
So you feel like Dylan White will, gas out, round, rounds 5 through 7, and then Joseph Parker will take over from there?
Yeah, I don't think he'll knock him out, but he will definitely probably outbox him toward the latter rounds and then win, Maybe a split, but he'll win the fight. You know, whether if it's a split or unanimous, he gonna win the fight, and it's gonna be the second half that wins him the fight, and he's just gonna win more rounds in the second half than Dillian White won in the first half.
Gotcha. So it'll probably be like a 8-4 type of 8-4 type of decision win for him.
Yeah, 8-4. That sounds pretty good. 8-4.
Gotcha. What you got on there, Matt?
Listen, I don't know what makes any of you guys think that Dillian White has a shot in this fight, okay? Dillian White is easy work for Joseph Parker. Parker is a much better boxer than Dillian White. And I think that Parker would have shown a lot more versus Anthony Joshua. Steffi, the referee, not broken him up every time they tried to get on the inside. You know, I think that what happened to Parker in the Joshua fight is tantamount to boxing malpractice. And I think that people are sleeping on the level of fighter that Joseph Parker is. To even mention Dillian White, a domestic fighter, in the same sentence as Parker, to me is insulting. And I think that Joseph Parker is going to show that he is a much better boxer. He has a much better chin. He has a much better stamina. And he is going to box circles around Dillian White.
Hopefully for you, that actually is the case, because Dillian White wins this fight, man. Yo, I don't know, man. I might have to call in and check on you, man, if Dillian White wins this fight. You are really, really dismissing Dillian White in this particular fight against Joseph Parker. And to me, I just feel that it's a kind of an even fight, personally, because when I look at Joseph Parker, I'm really not seeing anything out there that really impresses me about Joseph Parker. I didn't see it in his fight against Andy Ruiz. I didn't really see it in his fight against Ruslan Kajanu. I didn't see it against his fight against Huey Fury, where I really felt that Huey Fury kind of was doing a little bit better than Joseph Parker was, particularly in the first half of that fight. And I didn't really see anything from Joseph Parker that says, okay, I'm a heavyweight. I could go in there. I could hurt people. I could, you know, seriously damage people. You didn't see it in any of those fights. You didn't see it in his fight against Anthony Joshua. And it almost kind of seemed like he was too much of a gentleman in the boxing ring. And you can't really have that in the heavyweight division. And Dillian White is a dog in the ring, or, you know, more of a dog in the ring. He goes in there like he don't really give a fuck. You know what I'm saying? So with that type of mentality that you go in there, you don't really give a fuck, that's why I give the little edge to Dillian White. Of course, it's like in his, you know, home country there in the UK. So he's like, yo, I'm going in there. I'm ready to fight. I'm ready to take on anybody and everybody. And Joseph Parker is another person that's in the way of me trying to fight for a world championship. And it's me and try to prevent me from fighting for a world title, he's going to have to pay for it. I think that's going to be the mentality of Dillian White going into this fight against Joseph Parker, and I see him getting the win against Joseph Parker to move to 24-1. Now, after that, you're going to have the Showtime fight card headlined by the Unified Lightweight Championship between Mikey Garcia and Robert Easy Jr. Mike Garcia, multi-division world champion, already had went up to 140 and beat Adrian Broner, then got a 140-pound belt, and then after that relinquish it and said he'll come back down and defend the WBC version of that lightweight title, going up against Robert Easton Jr., you know, who won the IBF lightweight title against Richard Coleman in 2016, had a couple of fights defending the title over in Toledo, getting unanimous decision victories. And then he had his fight against Javier Fortuna over at Barclays Center, which he really performed that well. A good number of people there at Barclays felt that he lost that fight. He had, like, a lot of people there from Ohio, too, that were losing their voice, you know, cheering him on. He was there struggling, but he ended up getting the win there. But now he's here in the biggest fight of his career against Mikey Garcia, one of the most, you know, skilled fighters within the lower weight class. So that's what you have as far as, like, an initial preview there. I already had given my pick that I favor Mikey Garcia to win this fight. And that is what it is with that one. What you got there, Matt?
I think Garcia wins pretty easily. I was not impressed with Robert Easter in his last few fights, actually. I thought he lost his last couple of fights, and he was able to get the decision for whatever reason. You know, take that with it what you will. I think Mikey Garcia is obviously a supreme boxer, and I think that Mikey Garcia is going to be able to get in Easter's chest, and he's really going to test that chin. You know, Easter's a big guy, but he's not really a big puncher. So I think Mikey is the better puncher. Mikey's going to get inside his chest, and Mikey's going to make a very long night for Robert Easter.
Yeah. That's what I kind of like you out of this particular match. Mike Grady, what you got?
So the one chance that Robert Easter has is if he acts completely out of character and fights unlike himself. That's the one chance he has in this fight. If he jabs and moves. But unfortunately, let's say if he even comes in into round one and round two and he tries to implement that plan, y'all right, Mikey Garcia going to get in his chest and then he going to revert back to who he is, which is throwing hooks. And Mikey Garcia going to throw a hook, and then, you know, you got the longer fighter and you got the shorter fighter. The shorter fighter's in his chest throwing a hook. Shorter fighter's punch is going to land. And you're going to test his resolve. But hopefully he has some good metal about himself and, you know, he bites down and makes it a dog fight for Garcia, to where Garcia is at least is touch two. Because if he getting hit and he ain't hitting Garcia back, then yeah, this man gonna get stopped. If not stopped, you know, they're gonna you know, stop the fight or whatever. I like him sort of, you know, like I think he cool and, you know, certain other selfish reasons, but I just don't see it happening. Being impartial.
Back to Dillon White.
If Dillon White happens to win, I'm sure Deontay Wilder would be more than happy to knock his ass out.
I know that's right.
Hey, if you know, Deontay Wilder wants to, you know, fight Dillon White and, you know, not want to ask for $7 to $10 million to fight him, then hey, that's not a problem. You know, Dillon White can step in the ring. He may, you know, he'll eventually lose to Deontay Wilder, but he still will step in the ring to fight Deontay Wilder. It just won't be for $7 to $10 million. In this particular instance with Robert Easton Jr., or as they like to call him, Bunny, he has to be able to, like you said, move, jab and move, jab and move, jab and move, make Mikey can see a reset. You know, have to constantly think about what Robert Easter's next move is going to be. And I just see that just about every other advantage in this matchup goes to Mikey Garcia, and that includes trainers too. So I put Easter as a huge, actually a pretty huge underdog in this particular game. And then highly likely to suffer the loss of professional career.
I have a question
here. Yeah, go ahead.
Why do you think they accepted this fight? Like, what do they get out of accepting this fight?
Well, either fighter, to me, with this particular fight, it was proposed at one point, either like near the end of last year or the beginning of this year. But instead of that, you had, you know, Robert Easter Jr. have that, you know, fight in January as, you know, going up against Javier Fortuna in the undercard to Lamont Peterson and Errol Spence. And then Mike Garcia ended up, you know, going up to get that super lightweight title that he did. So, since that fight didn't come to fruition in the first half of this year, they said, you know what, let's try this again, let's make this happen, and let's have this be, you know, a unification fight, you know, for the lightweight championships there. So that's pretty much, you know, what we got out of this is that, you know, two guys there with two of the major belts there at lightweight, and they were able to put this fight together to make it happen. There. Also, side note for this fight card, you will have Luis Ortiz included in this fight card, and instead of fighting like Joe Hanks, there he's going to fight Ruslan Kanjanu, and it may possibly be the co-feature bout on Showtime. So be on the lookout for that to see Luis Ortiz back in the ring. For the first time since his loss to Deontay Wilder at the Barclays Center on March 3rd. So that's what we have there to cover for that particular card. And, you know, on that note, going to bring a close to this episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. We will get right back at it Sunday night, reviewing those fights that are happening over at the O2 Arena and also at the Staples Center and more. So be sure to catch all of that here on the GoFundMe Media Channel on Blog Talk Radio. And we will have the Cold Hard Truth on Sports tomorrow night starting at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time with Matt Long. So be sure to catch that here on the GoFundMe Media Channel. Like I say, at the end of the show, the Port of Boxing is a hit, and I can hit, not the stand and trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good evening, everybody.
All right.